The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Saturday afternoon with me, checking my sound here, with me, your host for the next 2 hours, Carolyn Yeager. Today is November 3rd, 2012. Today I'm going to tell you about some things that I have been learning about the infamous Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, what is called a gross forgery by all Jews and a number of revisionists and white nationalists, too, who haven't really looked into it all that well. At least that is my opinion after trying to catch up on it and learn what I failed to look into myself earlier. Now, I'm sure that some of you are interested in this, and some of you who will hear this will think right off the bat that you're not interested in it. This is a tired old topic, and why bring it up? Well, I think that if you listen to what I have to say today, you will discover that there's good reason to be interested in it. There's good reason to not give up on it, and the reasons why. So I do encourage people to stick with this, to stick with this 2 hours today and consider everything that's being said. Because, you know, it is a vast topic, and I'm not all that well prepared today, actually, to give a tight argument in favor of the protocols, and perhaps I would never give a tight argument in favor. It's one of those things that you either gravitate toward thinking they're worthwhile or you don't, but I can make a responsible start at it. I can tell you that. And I'm talking about it because I've learned things that have changed my mind about it. And I think that these are things that have not been, that are not being given, the proper kind of attention in the proper way. Either there's a lot of sensationalism, and I'm always talking about that, about the kind of sensationalism that we have around on the internet about things. And then you have the other opposite direction, the opposite of describing it as a known forgery, proven forgery, all of that, and people just not really being able to look into it, because the information that you need to know about it is not easy to find. It's not easy to find, and they make it hard, even harder to find and to figure out, as I'm going to point out. So why am I doing this, you might say? Well, on top of everything else, I want to keep following up on this because of what got started within the International Jew Study Hour that I do with Hadding Scott every Thursday night. And I really enjoy that program with Hadding, and the listeners like it. It has as many listeners as any of my other shows. And, so it's popular, and, it has piqued my interest. We're passing by on what we had to say about that on the International Jew, But now I'm wanting to continue on it separately a little bit, and I've got a lot of other things I want to keep up with, so it kind of gets overwhelming. But I have spent a lot of hours in this past week studying up on things, and this is what I'm going to share with you today, what I learned about it. And I'm going to keep the first hour of the show for myself for that reason, to make my case. And then I will take listener calls in the second hour because I don't have a guest. The number, which is not toll free, as you know, still is 830-443-4911. And I promise I will take calls in the second hour. Or you can send an email to carolyn@carolynyeager.com. As usual, I've got my email, that email box open, and everything's functioning fine. So we can do that. Now, before I start, I just want to mention a little item, a separate item about the elections. You know, Tuesday is election day, and I, for me, you know, I have been so anti-voting for a while, and I don't believe in the electoral process, truthfully, and I think it's pretty much fixed. But I'm not telling people to go out and vote. But I am going to vote myself this time. And I do, I just wanted to mention a blog by Pat Buchanan that I would recommend, people might want to read. I liked it. And, Pat Buchanan is a pretty good, solid white nationalist who has managed to walk that fine line between being, accepted as someone worth listening to in the mainstream, and also sticking to his principles for his own people. It's not easy to do, and nobody can do it perfectly. He hasn't done it perfectly. People can always complain about him, as I have done in the past, probably without good reason. But anyway, you can find that at his website, Buchanan.org. If you just go to Buchanan.org, and that blog, Romney for President, that I'm interested in, I think is good, might be the third or fourth one down now, since he wrote it. Now, many people are turned off by the protocols and the various issues that surround it, and are therefore willing to go along with the charge of forgery. And that, I think, is understandable, because when you spend any time studying this issue, it's so depressing, and it's even debilitating, because one is faced with such hatred, and this is a kind of hatred that we run into that's of a type that's outside of our experience, really. It's shocking, and it feels terrible. It's actually a projection. You know, well, it's not a projection, but the charge by organized jury of hatred against them, you know, hate, anti-Semitic hate and so on, is really a way that they turn it around and project what they do onto us, because their hatred of non-Jews who in any way discover something about what they're really up to or what they really are doing or anything that's not part of their lies and their story, that their narrative that they're putting out, is attacked as hate and is attacked so viciously. And I just had an attack like that this morning. For the first time, I got an email from the Jewish Defense League. And I'm not going to say any more about why I think I might have gotten it now and not ever before. But, you know, it just exudes such a level of viciousness that it's kind of, it's disturbing. It's disturbing to be approached with that. And think of what they were doing. Think of Henry Ford when he so courageously promoted the protocols and was writing his articles called The International Jew, The World's Problem, in his newspaper, putting it out. When they began attacking him, you know, it got to such a level that, you know, he had to drop it. He had to stop, because they were going to ruin him. And this idea that somehow he woke up and didn't believe anymore in what he was saying, what he had started out doing, is just false. Because when they go after people, they can really do a number on them. And this can be compared to the ceremony of exile. I don't know what it's called. I'll call it that. That's practiced by Jews on their own when they go against the following blindly along with the Jewish community and what everybody is supposed to say and believe and do. And we've seen this in modern days with people like Norman Finkelstein and others, but that is not as bad as what they actually used to carry out. And maybe they did carry this out on him. We know also about the revisionist Cole. What was his first name? David Cole. We don't know all the details, but they know we know that what they did to him was enough to cause him to just drop out of the picture altogether and even drop out of public life altogether. Nobody knows where he is or what happened to him. But an example that we read in the International Jew in the chapter that we just completed, Hadding and I, in chapter 15 of the International Jew, they give an example of Baruch Spinoza, famous philosopher, very famous today, who was Jewish, and he, though, didn't think that he wanted to agree with everything the Jews were doing. And for that reason, they did this excommunication of him, which was, you can read it in chapter 15 of the International Jew, which just gives a sense of the degree that they go to express their total anathema and cutting off and cursing of the person. And they're no longer alive. Even they have no, you know, they're dead to their community. They're cursed forever, and they're, you know, well, it goes on like that. excuse me. I was thinking about reading it, but it's too long, so I'll just leave it at that. But it's a kind of a blasting. They use the word blasting of the person, and everybody agrees, and they're just cut off and cut out forever. That's what they want to do if you don't. That's what they do if you don't go along with what they want. And this is a totally intolerant group of people. So some points that I want to make before I get started is that and I'll just reiterate that when you venture into the study of the protocols or discuss them or whatever, you're going into the midst I was going to say into the eye of the hurricane, but that's supposed to be a peaceful place. So you're going into the midst of a storm, and you should expect to experience that. And that's why a lot of people just would prefer, I think, to stay away from it and give it up, which is a very big mistake. Because among the things I've discovered is that, first, it's not true that the protocols were claimed by anybody. I think one person somewhere later on said this, but they were not claimed to have been intended for the first Zionist Congress. And somehow this is an impression that's given out, and I was under that impression, and I was not disabused of it by someone who I think should have been able to do that, but I was just encouraged to go on thinking that. And so that somehow was sufficient to make it into a forgery, because they say that they were supposed to be the minutes of this Zionist Congress, and they weren't. Well, then there's the other thing that they were, that they are intended for to be read out at some meeting, or they were the minutes of some secret meeting of Jews, Freemasonic meeting or something in France. But there's no actual proof of that either in the whole story, or there's nobody's claiming that really, unless some person here or there. But the whole story of how they came about, how they became known, is that there were copies of this, of these documents in the archives of a French Freemasonic lodge. And they were given to a Russian woman. A copy was sold by a Jew who was a member of that lodge, who stole a copy and gave it to this Russian woman who was an agent of the Tsar in Paris or in France. And then that person disappeared and was shortly found murdered in Egypt. So I'm going to get into this story a little bit later on, but I think it's far more believable than the a story that Philip Graves, who is the man who supposedly found proof that the protocols were simply a forgery from this little unknown book by Maurice Joly, and how that all came, how that got to Russia, and how that all happened. And I'll go through that shortly. So this is really where the basis of it is. And the second point I want to make is that there's a person called Adolf Grémieux, a Frenchman, a French Jew, who had possession of the protocols, or at least they were in the archives of the lodge that he was the head of. And that's this lodge is, I'll say what that is in a minute. And the third is that, there was a relationship between Joly and this Adolf Grémieux, at just the time when all these things were taking place. And it, very, very likely that Grémieux influenced Joly and may have written parts of the dialogues that carry Joly's name or advised Joly on it, so that it would be that Grémieux, who was either the author of the protocols or knew what they were, had given information to Joly about them before these protocols ever saw the light of day, because they were not ever intended to see the light of day. So this is where it gets complicated, and you have to keep in mind the time, the years that things are going on, because it's the charge is that the protocols were written in 1905. Well, they weren't necessarily written in 1905. They were discovered and they were translated. They got into the hands of Gentiles, of some Russians in 1905 or thereafter, and then they were translated into Russian because they were in French. Let's remember this. The protocols, the original protocols, were in French and they were in France. And they were probably associated with the French Freemasonry, which was very active, very powerful at the time. So, it's really hard for me to have all this organized because I didn't have time to really get it organized, but I'm just going to do the best I can here by starting out with telling you about Maurice Joly and his relationship with Grémieux, because I think it's really a really vital part of it. Maurice Joly, some people say he was a Jew. I've read that already. Probably not, so we'll call him a Gentile. His father was an Italian Mason, and he, growing up in France, was also a Mason. He was also tied to the Alliance Israelite Universelle, Joly was, through his association with the Freemason Grémieux, Adolf Grémieux, and the Mizraim Masonic Lodge. That's the one I couldn't think of the name of earlier. Grémieux was very essential in forming the Scottish Rite Lodge in France. And the Scottish Rite had a kind of an offshoot called the Mizraim Masonic Lodge, which also became known later, or another version of it, the Memphis Lodge. But this was more occult and more Kabbalistic, more openly so. And it was at this Mizraim Lodge that that as the story goes, the protocols were taken from the archives in this lodge, which Adolf Grémieux was the head of. He was the head of this lodge, of the Mizraim Masonic Lodge. Or if he wasn't officially the head, he was unofficially the head of it. And Joly was also, so Joly was, knew Grémieux. Okay, we'll get into that a little more, but he was also linked to the Priory of Zion through mutual membership in a rose croix order with Victor Hugo. These are all Freemasonic things. So while Jolie may have had Jewish blood or may not, we're not going to say that, he was very big in Freemasonry, and he was therefore knew all the Jews and so on, and had no problem with that. Now, this Masonic influence secured Jolie a post in the Ministry of the Interior under Freemason M, I don't know what that stands for, Chevreau, just before the coup d'etat in 1851 by Louis Napoleon. So right before 1851, Jolie had gotten a post in the government under a Freemasonic president, or whatever his post was as Chevreau at the time, in a republic. So then Louis Napoleon got power, and Jolie was not included in the new government of Napoleon the Third, nor did he want to be, it is said, because he had a hatred of the Bonapartes. And he disagreed with Grand Orient politics, which demanded a strong man to solidify its failing revolution of 1848. Bonaparte was considered to be like a strong man. And Bonaparte was also a Mason. And he was also very much involved in all of these things. So in the Grand Orient Lodge, which I guess was a different one from the Scottish Rite. But in any case, for 9 years following Napoleon's coup, Jolie was not a part of any political movement or the government or anything, and he had withdrawn from politics and spent his time with his law practice. He was a lawyer. And then suddenly, we are told, in 1860, he began writing articles attacking the government and the emperor. In 1860, keep that in mind, because that was in 1864, he published this Dialogues. So now the question is, who or what rekindled Jolie's anger against Napoleon? Well, the answer can very well be Adolphe Cremieux, who also hated the emperor. He also had hopes. He helped Napoleon III regain power to whatever extent he had. He was on Napoleon III's side. And then when Napoleon took power, he didn't give Adolphe Cremieux the position that he wanted. He wanted to be chief executive in Napoleon's government. At the time of Napoleon's coup, he was legal advisor to the Bonaparte family, and he was an intimate of Louis Napoleon. So he was very offended when Napoleon became emperor, and he did not appoint him to the post that he wanted, which was chief executive in his government, and it was a position vital in dealing with Great Britain. And there are connections made between Cremieux and Disraeli in Britain, who, another Jew. I mean, Cremieux was known to be a Jew, and Disraeli was a Jew who had gotten this high position as prime minister in Great Britain. So it is said that this was a mistake, in a sense, of Louis Napoleon, because now Cremieux was his enemy, and Jolie was his enemy, and they had that in common, and they did associate with one another. And I don't have the material about that, which I did have, which I had read and looked at, but, you know, I've got tons of material here, folks, to be dealing with. So this is a real and historical connection between Jolie and Cremieux and anti-Napoleon III. And they knew each other, and also the fact that it is said, and I think reliably so, this story about how the protocols were taken from this lodge that was run by Cremieux. Now let's see what else I've got here about Cremieux. All right, I might not be pronouncing his name exactly, but it's close. He did much. He was very much an advocate for the Jews, openly so, openly. He was a real ugly guy, too, but, you know, but supposedly brilliant, absolutely brilliant, and he just, you know, he just could win. Every case he went into and everything that he tried to do, he won out. So, for example, in 1827, he advocated the repeal of a certain kind of legislation that was left over from pre-revolutionary France that stigmatized the Jews. And he got rid of that stigmatization of the Jews in France. And then he founded the Alliance Israelite Universelle in 1860. And this is a big thing. For those of you who don't know, look it up. I will have a little more to say about that if I don't have it right here in this. I've got some information on it. Oh, I've got a whole little couple pages I might read if I have time about it at the end. But it was he became its president, and he remained president of the Alliance Israelite Universelle for, like, I think I added up 17 years or 13 years, something like that, for, you know, all during that very important period of time. And this was the attempt of what you might say international Jewry, to make Jewry international, to say we Jews, we're not being given what we want in individual nations. We really don't belong in individual nations. We have our own nation. We are, you know, a universal Jewish nation all around the world, and we need an alliance of our own to represent that. In essence, a nation. They proclaimed themselves a nation of their own in 1860 with this alliance. And in 1866, 6 years later, Cremieux traveled to St. Petersburg and he successfully defended the Jews of Saratov, who had been accused in a case of blood libel. Well, you know, a lot of these cases of blood libel, I believe, and it has been shown, are true. And there's a famous one that will come up here. They were busy defending themselves. And this, again, shows us that whenever it is something that shows the Jews in a bad light, and actually the way they really are, they go all out to knock that down, to do that in. And he was very important to the Jews, this Cremieux, because he was an excellent lawyer and very smart, they say. And that's why he could have written a lot of that. That's why he could have written all these things. He could be the author himself, because he had such a great supposedly genius mind. And so, you know, when they have cases of blood libel against Jews, they go all out to win and then to attack and accuse those who have brought that and defame them and slander them, and call it a big lie and, as you know what they do. So, what I just told you was from Wikipedia. Metapedia, I also have, of course, Wikipedia said this too, but his, Cremieux's real name, he was born Isaac Moisia, but he became known as Adolf Cremieux. You see how he didn't have a French name even, but he developed one. He was a prominent Jewish Freemason. As I said, he was Minister of Justice in France for a period of time. He was extremely influential. He founded the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which they call a Jewish supremacist organization. And also, the big thing was, that's what I was just telling you about. That was a different one. He involved himself in the Damascus Affair. The Damascus Affair was, that comes up later too. Some more about him, where another case where three Jews, I remember it now, three Jews were accused and found guilty of murdering a friar or a father of the Roman Catholic Church. I have his name somewhere. and for blood libel. I mean, to drain his blood, to get his blood. You know, it was a blood right type of murder. They wanted his blood for their blood rights. And he was found guilty. And then this Cremieux went there to argue for him. And I think he got those guys off, or in any case, he was very involved in that. And he was the Grand Master, it says, of the Scottish Rite in France, the Grand Master. And he was also very involved in the Rite of Misraim. That was that kind of offshoot from the Scottish Rite. Okay, the next thing I want to bring up, to poke at this, to poke at the story as it exists, is that the protocols are forgery and were plagiarism from Maurice Joly. Now, I've made the point in the past that that it has been found that the parallel passages, so to speak, in the protocols from Joly's dialogues in Hell amount to 1/6 of the protocols. I think now that it doesn't amount to that much. Someone else has said it was 5%. And as I looked at some of these passages, there's some that are pretty close, but there's a lot that you can't even find all of them. Nobody has published them all. That's the thing. They only publish the ones that are the best ones, and they don't publish the rest, but they say they've got all these. Well, what it is, there's words that are the same, they're on the same kind of idea, but they're not exact. And I have now read the dialogues in Hell, or I read enough of it. I read the version that Peter Myers gave, but actually I found out that large parts of it are left out of his, of what he links to. But I found another one just this morning, that is complete and very long. And I went through that, and I have read a lot of the protocols, and you know, it's true that they don't sound the same. I mean, the whole way the protocols is written is very different from the way this dialogues is written, and what it's getting at is different. In the dialogues between Machiavelli and Montesquieu is more detailed about the current period of time, about Napoleon III and the French government and the various parties and what they wanted and the various political ideas and so on. It gets very detailed and right then, whereas in the protocols, it is very much written as a plan of how they will take over. Rather different. Has a different tone to it. But not to go off too much on that, I want to mention, okay, here that on the Wikipedia page for the protocols of the Elders of Zion, that is such a misleading and Jew-controlled page. You know, I found that, and I'm not even prepared to go into all the little details. Like when you look at the footnotes, all the places where it says citation needed, where they say things that they don't have a source for, and when they do have a source, you look at some of the sources are so awful. They're just Jewish, you know, BS and so on, and written by people who you wouldn't, you know, have a bias in what they want to say. And otherwise, just in general, for insisting that it's known to be a forgery, and everybody agrees, there's no other way to look at it. Well, they also have three items, actually six. Three from the dialogues. They're comparing some of the passages, these passages that are supposed to have been plagiarized. So they're comparing three passages from the dialogue in Hell and three passages from the protocols, which are very, very, very similar. And they say, see, these are the proof and of how it was copied from Joly, and And there's actually, they say, there's a whole lot more of it. But what they show here, you know, and I had to look through all these, look through both of these books to the other one, the dialogue you can find online, to find it. And you know, here's one thing they do to confuse people so you can't really look it up. In the dialogues, they give the page number. Well, the copy of the dialogues that was not complete, that Peter Myers linked to, used page numbers, but they weren't the same as these page numbers. But some of it was kind of close. But the dialogue that I found that was complete, that was the best one to use, didn't use page numbers. It was divided into dialogues because there's like 25 or 26 or something dialogues, and it just said, you know, which dialogue it was in. So there's no page numbers to go by. So I had to just kind of guess at where it might be and try to find it. And the same with the protocols. They use page numbers, but the protocols come in all different versions. And the version that I have is in a book, you know, put out by Liberty Bell Press, something like that, that's sold by, I can't even think of it now. But that's what I am using. Or I could go to the, it has page numbers, but they don't correspond at all with the page numbers that are used here. And sometimes, you know, if they'd say what protocol it was, it'd be a lot more helpful. If they say that this quote here is found in protocol, and which number it is, because there are 24 protocols. And then you could go to that protocol and look for it. But looking for page numbers, when all the versions are using different, because the one I've got here is in the book form is the actual protocols is just a part of some bunch of other chapters in it with other information. So it doesn't start at page one and go on through it. It's totally different pages, page numbers. So I had that difficulty to overcome, and I'm sure they do that on purpose. And so what I found finally was that the first one that they talk about loans and how it goes after 20 years and after 40 years and you still have your full debt. That's found in both the dialogues, and it's found in the protocols. It's not such a big deal that you know, you're talking about how loans are set up. It is written very similarly, so it could have been copied one from another, but also in the way that I mentioned earlier as to who was copying who. And then the second one in the dialogues on that wiki page is the god Vishnu. Like the god Vishnu, my press will have 100 arms, and these arms will give their hands. At first, I couldn't find that, but when I finally found the full version of the protocols, I did find it in protocol 12, that they said that very, almost exactly the same. It's one sentence, you know, one sentence. And then then the last one they use, which is again talking about the god Vishnu, and this was supposedly on page 207, whereas the first Vishnu quote is on page 141, but the first quote about the loans is on page 209. So the page 207 quote about Vishnu and his hundreds of arms and so on, each finger touching a spring, should have been right before the talk about the loans, according to what they've got here. But I didn't find it. So that's one I don't think exists, because I went through those dialogues, Jolie's dialogues. I went through from 17 to 21. And the page 209 was found in dialogue 20. So page 207 would be in dialogue 20 or maybe dialogue 19. Well, I didn't find it, and I went on to 18 to 17, and I also looked at 21. And you know, I can recognize the word Vishnu in 100 arms when I see it, and it just wasn't there. So I don't know if it might be somewhere else, but they're not giving you the right information here. And but it is true that in the protocols, this thing about the god Vishnu is mentioned twice. And I do have it here in protocol 12 and then again in protocol 17. And I imagine that at that time, using that as an example of how somebody can get a whole lot of things done, or they have a lot of agents working and so on, that using the god Vishnu and his 100 arms, or, you know, why they always use the word 100, but he's just supposed to have a lot of them. And then all those hands, you know, working all at the same time, doing things, would not have been an unusual simile to use. And it brings to mind, like, what if today, what if in the future, somebody was looking up some things, conspiracy things, whatever, and say, oh, this person wrote, you know, the phrase that's so common? There's so many of them I could come up with, but I just came up with this one. It's the economy, stupid. How many people have used "it's the economy, stupid"? How common is that to say it in one way or another? So if you could find, if you wanted to make a match, you could say, well, this person used the phrase "it's the economy, stupid," and then this other person used that too. So, you know, they are plagiarizing from him. Well, it doesn't mean it's plagiarizing. I'm not insisting that what's in the protocols is actually some things of it are in the dialogues. But the question is, who took from whom? And that is a legitimate question. It might seem like a tricky kind of thing, just trying to get out of the whole, you know, issue, or, you know, being conspiratorial with no evidence. But there is a lot of there is reason to believe that the protocols existed in some form before these dialogues were written, and that the person who wrote the dialogues had some connection, which is, if it is Jolie, had some connection with people who knew about the protocols. And somehow, you know, and they may have helped him with his book. Cremieux may have helped Jolie, being that they were on the same side. Excuse me, at that time. And he may have gotten advice, or he may have suggested things to him, or he may have shown him things to read. Because it, we can't say that Jolie was capable of writing that whole dialogues on his own without any help. You know, that was such an easy thing to do. It's not as heavy as the protocols, but it's still very complex. Complicated, and it's focused on the times in which they were living. So all of this, these questions have not been answered. We're just supposed to believe what they say. See, we're supposed to believe whatever they put out, but what is put out on the other side, I'll say our side, the non-Jewish side, is supposed to be looked at skeptically. And, oh, there's no proof of this, or, oh, why should we believe that? You know, so it's a one-sided situation, as it always is. Now I'm going to go on to the idea of how this plagiarism came to light. You know, a lot has been made that, oh, Philip Graves exposed the protocols as a plagiarism in the London Times in 1921, and he's the first one who published this evidence that the protocols was not an authentic document, by showing that parts of it were taken from Jolie's dialogues in Hell, which were written in 1868, or was it 1864? Get my years mixed up here. And the dialogues, they like to say that the protocols, I mean, were written in 1905. Well, they weren't written in 1905. Who, you know, they arrived. Here's a story. where am I going to find that story? Well, I'm not going to jump around. So the story, I kind of went over the story fast earlier, but I'm going to continue here with Graves, and then I'll go back to that. So here's what Graves said, and here's something about Graves. This is the person who discovered that the protocols were a forgery. He was born into a prominent Anglo-Irish family. He studied at a fancy school and then at Oxford University. As a correspondent of the Times in Constantinople from 1908 to 1914. So that's 6 years. For 6 years, he was in Constantinople. Think about what kind of place Constantinople is, with all the intrigue and so on. And he reported on the events preceding World War I in 1914. He had to leave the Ottoman Empire because he was a British citizen. He had to leave because of the war. So in during the war, he served in the British Army in the Middle East War Theater. Excuse me. He was, excuse me, he was a captain in Army Intelligence in Cairo. And he worked, he was always out of the country, and he worked with T.E. Lawrence on the Turkish Army Manual for the Arab Bureau. His uncle had been a British consul in Erzurum and financial advisor to the Turkish government, and he and his uncle worked for civil intelligence in Cairo during the same period. And, you know, Graves was in Cairo as an army with army intelligence during the war. So he's not, I don't see him as someone who would be reading the protocols of Maurice Joly. But I see him as someone who was involved in a lot of intelligence and was therefore put up to it by Jewish forces, who found him a good person, since he was a Times correspondent, to do this job for them. I think that makes a lot of sense, although, you know, there's nobody can say one way or the other at this point. Now, here's another little point that Alan Dulles, according to a writer called Peter Groves, Alan Dulles was in Constantinople, at developing relationships in post-Ottoman political structures. And, that he played a part in this. It says that he discovered the source of the documentation ultimately provided to the Times. Well, the source is this Mr. X that I'm going to read to you about. Am I ready for that now? I think so. Okay, I'm going to go here. Here you can find on Wikisource the truth about the protocols as it appeared in the Times in 1921 on August 16th, 17th, and 18th. And the story, I'd like to read all of this, but... Well, it gives a little introduction about what the protocols are. And then it says that the Times presents for the first time conclusive proof that the document is in the main a clumsy plagiarism. Our Constantinople correspondent has forwarded to the Times a copy of the French book from which the plagiarism is made. And the British Museum has a complete copy of the book, which is the Dialogues by Joly. So we go on to what Graves, the correspondent, writes. He says, there is one thing about Constantinople that is worth your while to remember. A diplomatist told him in 1908. This is the advice he got from this diplomat. If you only stay here long enough in Constantinople, you will meet many men who matter, and you may find the key to many strange secrets. But Graves says, yet I must confess that when the discovery which is the theme of these articles, was communicated to me, I was at first incredulous. Mr. X, he calls him, who brought me the evidence, was convinced. He said, read this book through, and you will find irrefutable proof that the protocols of the learned elders of Zion is a plagiarism. Well, Graves writes, Mr. X, who does not wish his real name to be known, naturally, is a Russian landowner with English connections. Well, sure, he's not a Jew. He was probably a Jew and some few Jews, who knows, that Graves was associated with or that the Times was even friendly to. But anyway, he's calling him a Russian landowner with English connections. Orthodox by religion, he is in political opinion a constitutional monarchist. He came here as a refugee after the final failure of the white cause in South Russia. He has long been interested in the Jewish question as far as it concerned Russia, has studied the protocols, and during the period of Denikin's ascendancy, see, so this is how Philip Graves did not study the protocols. He got all this from this Mr. X, who has studied the protocols and is an expert on some of these things. And he's made investigations with the object of discovering whether any occult Masonic organization, such as the protocols speak of, existed in southern Russia. Although, you know, what does it matter what was in Russia? Because the whole thing took, you know, was from France. But anyway, the only such organization was a monarchist one. The discovery of the key to the problem of the protocols came to him by chance. A few months ago, he bought a number of old books from a former officer of the Okhrana political police who had fled to Constantinople. That's where Graves was. Among these books, but this is where Mr. X is too. Among these books was a small volume in French, lacking the title page, with dimensions of 5.5 by 3.75. It had been cheaply rebound. On the leather back is printed in Latin capitals the word Joli, J-O-L-I. The preface entitled Simple Avertisement is dated Geneva, October 15, 1864. The book contains 320, okay, it goes on. And he says that he's describing this book, which they present it as being almost impossible to find. It was impossible to find. This Mr. X came into possession of one. They're trying to point out here how genuine this book is, and they say it's not a fake. Anybody who's seen the book can tell that the book is not a fake and all so on. Its original possessor, the old Okhrana officer, did not remember where he obtained it, of course, and I attached no importance to it. Mr. X glanced at it one day, was struck by a resemblance between a passage which had caught his eye and a phrase in the French edition of the protocols, which he was very familiar with. He followed up the clue and soon realized that the protocols were to a very large extent as much a paraphrase of the Geneva original. The dialogues in hell are also often called the Geneva dialogue for whatever reason, something to do with French. As the published version, it was, he says that he realized that the protocols were a paraphrase of this, dialogue, this Joly original, as the published version of a War Office or Foreign Office telegram is a paraphrase of the ciphered original. Now, I haven't studied that idea, but I can probably find fault with that. But you see, now I want to ask you, ladies and gentlemen, does this sound like a convincing story? We know how the Jews operate. They don't try to make their stories very convincing. I guess they can't. They don't worry about it too much. Whatever story they put out is considered, everybody accepts it, is considered okay. But this story is far inferior, even so far, and I'm not done with it yet, to the story of how the protocols were discovered or came to light and were taken to, a copy taken to the Tsar, and this woman kept a copy, and she handed it over when she got back to Russia to this friend. And we'll go into that too, because he sounds very legitimate, and so do the two people that got a copy, one of which was Nihlus. But the London article, and by this guy's name, I'm going to have to look for it again, Philip Graves, says before receiving the book from Mr. X, as I have said, incredulous. I did not believe that Nihlus's protocols were authentic. They explain too much by the theory of a vast Jewish conspiracy. See, they're now spending their time in the Times with propaganda, putting down the protocols, repeating all the things that the Jews say about it. And it was too melodramatic to be credible. It was hard to believe that these learned elders would not have produced a more intelligent political scheme than the crude and theatrical subtleties of the protocols. But I could not have believed that that the writer who supplied Nihlus with his originals was a careless and shameless plagiarist. You see how they interweave their propaganda throughout all this, which again makes you realize that it's just exactly what the Times and the New York Times too do today, have always done, and we will continue with this. I will check my email, and I will answer the phone if anybody calls in. And when we get back for the second hour, but I have a lot more to cover. So stay with me, and see you in 5 minutes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and we are talking. This is the second hour of a program about the protocols and why the protocols of Zion should not so quickly be accepted as a forgery, as having been solidly proved to be a forgery, as is so commonly done today by so many. As I mentioned in the beginning, not only all Jews are ready to say that and do say that, but many even revisionists and white nationalists go along with it. And I did a little explaining why I thought some reasons were. I won't go over that because I want to move right along. And I told people that that they could call in this hour, and the phone number is 1-830-443-4911. Right at the moment, I'm reading something that's covering up my my SkyCon page, which shows me when someone is on the phone. And also, I've got something else on top of the Skype page, which shows me. I guess I can bring that up. I can bring that up while I'm doing this other. Okay. Little moving around here. Okay. So, but I didn't have any emails. So let me just continue. I was talking about how this big exposure of the forgery was written up in the Times of London in 1921. And this, I have the article here from the Times and what it said. And it's called The Truth About the Protocols. And they're calling the dialogues, the Joly dialogues, the Geneva dialogues, and the Geneva book, and so on. So they describe that, what that is all about. I'm not going to read that part. And then they say they're going to call. They talk about the prince, and so on. See, I've still got that part. They say the protocols follow. I'm trying to look and see what part I should read here. They say the protocols follow almost the same order as the dialogues. Well, almost is should be emphasized. They don't follow the same order. Dialogues 1 through 17 generally correspond with protocols 1 through 19. Boy, generally is really the important word there. They don't correspond. They're very different, but they're talking about similar things. They're talking about political intrigue, and they're talking because it's Machiavelli talking with Montesquieu, who is more of a humanitarian, and Machiavelli is giving all of his plans on how he would, you know, use force and power and without any sympathy for anybody, and terror and so on to rule. And so the protocols also are similar to that, you know, talking about that. But and that's where the similarity ends. And you have to look at them to realize that this, trying to say that these things are so close together or so much alike, is a complete falsification. They're not. You can make connections between things. And there are some, passages which are very much the same, short passages. And that's what they use to prove all this. Now, that is a problem, but it can be explained in other ways. It doesn't necessarily mean that the whole thing of the protocols is just a plagiarism. Because, well, I think I'm not going to go through all this. Because I already pointed out that it's hard to find where they are, because they don't give you the right information to find what is the same. Here's I'll wait and come back to that. Right now I'm going to move on get back to my regular page. Now this Graves, I wrote about Graves, okay, read about that. Now, it said that Joly's book is, I think, before I go into that, I'm going to read this from... what is this, anyway? It's very good. I forget where I got it, but I'm going to read it. What is a protocol? Okay, the word protocol means a draft of a document or the summation of the minutes of meetings. So by calling it the protocols, that's where you got the idea that these were minutes for a meeting, or minutes that were given at a meeting, or were minutes of a meeting, or were to be used at a meeting. But anyway, it says that but what it is discussions given in the innermost circle of the world's leading Jews condensed into a succinct form. Well, it is condensed into a succinct form for some purpose, and it is a discussion of somebody talking to a group of people, talking to other people, and giving them information, telling them things, and so on. And if it is what it says it is, and if it is written by Jews, then while the Jews could not suppress the protocols in the West, their strategy was the same as what a Jewish lawyer uses when he is losing a case. That is, he jumps from defending a losing case to trying to discredit the character of the opponent. This is very, very obvious here, in that the protocols came out, in 1905, 1906, 1907, and they were published, and they were translated and sent to Europe and so on. But it wasn't until 1917 and the Russian Revolution that all of a sudden everybody had heard about it. They started being really taken seriously, and everybody was reading them, and it got very, very scary. It was looking like they were going to just be a sensation all over the world. Well, they had already kind of become a sensation around the world. And then the Jews decided that they had to do something about this. Now, again, in this, it's talking about. Before I get on to, that's their main way of dealing with things is when they can't defend it, they try to discredit the character of the opponent. So that's what they're doing here with this story in the Times, that they're using all their abilities and connections to make it look like somebody was carrying out plagiarism, somebody was carrying out forgery, somebody was trying to once again discredit, anti-Semites were at work and so on. This is how they approached it, because they couldn't account for these protocols. So they came up with this story about Mr. X and so on. But since that wasn't very strong, they used a lot of defamation and slander and so on to go along with it. So now the question is, who wrote the protocols? And we may never know for sure, but it seems improbable that either a Russian mystic or a bigoted Russian policeman or a French lawyer could have come up with an analysis so penetrating and so unfailingly prophetic. Well, that's a bit of propaganda there, too. But really, can you imagine that... that Nihilus wrote this, or, in order to make it look bad for the Jews, or that a Russian policeman, I'll stop there. Could have done it. I know who wrote this. I know what this is from. This is from the ruffle-crested Kikes or something like that article. It's pretty good, though. It's very good. And you can find that at, well, I can't say right at the moment. I'll have it. I'll link to it. This person thinks that they are written by Adolf Isaac Cremieux, the Grand Master of the Masonic Grand Orient and Scottish Rite Lodge of Mizraim in France, and one of the founders of the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which we had talked about. And he that is a possibility, but I don't think that it pays to say, you know, well, it was this person or it was that person, because it's unknown. But he certainly is the most suspicious character in dealing with the protocols, because according to the story by Miss Glinka, this Mademoiselle Glinka, she obtained her copy from a Jew who was a member of that lodge, she paid him a large sum of money for it, which came from the Russian government. And for that, he was like a traitor. He had access to these documents. I guess there were some copies of them. And he took one, and he sold it to her. And then he went to Egypt with the money. But, you know, very shortly afterwards, he was found murdered in Egypt. So they found him and they murdered him. And this is not anything far out. And then she took her copy to Russia and she handed it over. Let's see if I get to that part. I'm sorry, I'm so disorganized. Okay. Here's something. After Kremieux's death in 1880, there is enough of a power vacuum at the Masonic Lodge of Mizraim that a relaxation of its secretive nature must have been felt by some of its members. So, you know, Kremieux died in 1880, and this important document, what we know as the protocols, was handed over to Miss Glinka they call her Miss, it would be Mademoiselle Glinka, but anyway, in 1884, or thereabouts. Okay. So that shortly after, some years, just a couple years, few years after Kremieux's death, things were not as tight there at that lodge. Maybe there was, who knows what was going on, but this Joseph Schorst is his name. This Jew named Joseph Schorst was a member of this Mizraim Lodge, and he had access. So he decided to, as so many people do, and many Jews are traitors, you know, and sellouts. And he knew about Glinka, and he offered to give it to her, I guess, for that sum of money. She got hold of that money and gave it to him, and she got the document from him. This is a story that you never hear about, because they want to say that this thing was written, who knows by whom, in Odessa or somewhere in Russia or somewhere, and Nihlus was given to Nihlus, or maybe Nihlus wrote it. And then he tried to pawn it off, you know, and then gave it to the secret police of Russia, or maybe the secret, other stories are that the secret police of Russia wrote this up as propaganda. Now, how could the Russian secret police write such a document as the protocols? Even Nihlus couldn't write such a document. No, nobody could, except somebody like Adolf Kremieux and his associates, in international Jewry and Freemasonry. Only they could write such a thing. So okay, we got that. Now here's the thing, I didn't think I'd have time for this, so I don't have the details here, but I can probably talk about it a little bit, because it's in the protocols book. This Linka woman went back to Russia. She was called back to Russia, and she took with her a copy. She had another copy made. She had that first one translated, the one she got from, supposedly that she got from Schorst. She had, it was in French. She had it translated into Russian, and then she sent it to Russia. And she had the other one translated. She kept one. She had another translation into Russian, and she returned to Russia with it. And she gave it to a government official by the name of Alexis Sukhotin, S-U-K-H-O-T-I-N. And there's information about Sukhotin. I hope I have it here, available. I don't, but he's a real person. He fits the description of a responsible person who he was anti-Bolshevist and all that. And he looked at it, he read it. It was now in Russian, and he showed it to two friends, Philip Stepanov and Sergei Nihlus. And well, there's a whole story about. Let me see if I can go there. I don't have the right. I close windows because I've got too many open, and then I don't have the right ones open. So, anyway, this I'm making a mess here now. This Stepanov did something with it. He showed it to some friends, and he sent it around to some people. And that his story is all very believable, and he's a real person. And this Alexis Sukhotin. These the liars behind the forgery claim say that when the dialogues book that they received that is the only one that was found in Russia, and I think had belonged to the secret police there. But it had the initials AS written on the back. And so they say, well, it could have been this person. You know, well, you'd think it probably was him. So you'd think that he was using it. He maybe wrote the protocols, and he was using that book, that little dialogues book that they found, that they say was the only one around, that nobody, you know, it was something, it was so forgotten about that nobody knew anything about it. Well, anybody can put initials AS on a book that they have. And these people now had that book, and they say that they saw that initials AS on the back. I wouldn't believe that at all. And the other thing is that, I forgot what I was going to say, that they had, oh yeah, that they say this book was so secret and impossible to find. Well, actually, it is said that it was in the libraries in France, and it was not forgotten about. It was not so unknown. It was known, and so that's another lie. Now, there's quite a few lies that they come up with, and I don't know. I know. Here's my other stuff. Okay. Okay, some of the things about this, some of the things about the protocols that we can question is that is the percentage is actually the amount from Jolie's book that is in the protocols. One source says that it's less than 5%, and I would say that might be true because originally the general consensus is that it's well, some people say it's like 20%, but others, somebody proved that it was only 1/6, so like 12% or something. But when you look at what they call similar stuff, it's so far-fetched. You know, it's not that similar. It's not that exact at all. So you find some of it is just phrases and words and so on, or something where they're writing about the same thing. So it might be, if you took a real strict view of it, it might be about 5%. Now, a lot of this is stuff I've already said. So now, the newspapers, you know, when they announce the discovery of proof, starting with the Times in London, they didn't offer proof. They came up with this weird story, see? And the only thing that they had to go by was was the similarity between the Joly book and the protocols. And they are not all that honest about that. So, and then they bring up a lot of other people, like the Gucci book and the other books that wrote about similar things. So that the fact is that what's in Joly's book was I can't even read my own notes here. It's too complicated. That there are several books going around at this time plagiarizing one another, supposedly. I've talked about this before, and showing, you know, talking about the same things and taking things from one another. So once again, I need to get to this part that I know what I need to get to. The newspapers of the world announced the discovery of proof of that. Oh, okay. One piece of work is influenced by another, it's not plagiarism. I think the best argument here is that the connection between, which I've given, between Cremieux and Joly, and their similar political beliefs and paths, and that they were both Freemasons, that they knew each other. I had something that really went into how well they knew each other and how they worked together. I don't know where it is, but so that, I think, shows that what was in that, probably the protocols were something that was an ongoing manuscript. They weren't even, well, I guess they were called protocols. Okay. Was an ongoing work that was probably used and had been used for some time. And it was on, it was archived there at this lodge because Cremieux had a whole lot to do with it. And therefore, it could be that what was in Joly's book, as I already pointed out, I think I can't point it out too much though, is that that was taken. Joly was influenced by Cremieux and what he had, what he knew about that was already in these, what are called the protocols, rather than the other way around. I think that's very, that's an area that needs to be looked into more. And many people have accepted that. I mean, there are some people and not too many people that get involved in all of this, but, they have accepted that. But of course, all we ever hear is the loud noises from the media. That's all we ever hear. Now trying to find something new here. Okay. So, we had, the Bern, Switzerland, trial. So it's said that, when the forgery, you know, even though the forgery claim came out and the Times played it up and they all played it up, it was played up everywhere as big as possible, people were still not convinced by that, and they were still reading the protocol, still believing, you know, what it was, still believing that there was a Jewish plan to gain control over the whole world and so on, and they were still very interested in all this. So the Jews had not yet solved the problem, and so in order to do this, they decided that they needed to have a legal decision. A legal decision saying that they do the same thing with the Holocaust. And I could draw a lot of parallels to the Holocaust if I had it all together here. But they wanted to have a legal decision saying that this is a forgery. So they took their time and they picked out Switzerland to put it to a trial. And they even had the judge ahead of time, a man named Meyer, Judge Meyer, who would go along with them, who they had in their, under their control, so to speak. and would, you know, sell out. And then they had in Switzerland, they had a law forbidding the circulation of matter likely to incite to crime, lead to immorality, shock the sense of decency, or provoke to depravity. You know, material like that makes you think of pornography, right? It's really, that was really a law forbidding the public circulation of sexually explicit and, you know, depraved literature and so on. That's what that was for. But they, the Jews figured that that was the best they had going for them, because it wasn't against the law to sell the protocols and to put out this pamphlet, which a lot of people were doing in Europe, you know, just going out and handing out this protocols pamphlet and stuff to people. So they were doing what should have been done. They were really working at it back then. So doing so many things that today we don't even try to do anymore. That's part of the point I'd like to make. So they targeted four men who had been selling this material. Not selling, giving it out. Maybe they were selling it. But, you know, handing it out on the street, this protocols material. And they brought a legal charge against them using this, this law, of selling indecent and immoral literature. And the court accepted it, which probably shouldn't have, but it did, because they brought it up, came up under Judge Meyer. Now, Judge Meyer was a communist. We know that much about him. And this was in, when was this? I'll get to it when this came to court. This was in the 1930s. Wow. Wait a minute. Judge Meyer was a communist, and he permitted the case to be enlarged by the complainants, the Jews, from a simple police court action, which was what it would be, selling indecent literature, into a question of the history and authenticity of the protocols. So, with respect to the authenticity of the protocols, Judge Meyer said, the defendants have been unable to prove that the protocols of the Elders of Zion were a genuine document. Well, that shouldn't have been in the, you know, that shouldn't have been covered under the law as it was, because the law didn't have a law about whether something was a genuine document or not. But that's what this judge did with it, and nobody stopped him. Naturally, if you've got control of the legal situation, there's nothing you can really do against it. I mean, nobody can make any headway against it, as again we know from all the Holocaust laws. Now, a quote is, the Bern trial was declared by the Swiss appeals courts to have been a travesty of justice. Okay, so I've left too much out of this, but anyway, because I thought I'd be short of time. Okay. These guys were found guilty and they appealed. All right. They were found guilty. These four men. And here's another thing. They allowed, about 12 witnesses, to come forth and give their testimony against the defendants or the Jews. And then when it came time for the defendants to have their turn, and they had 20 witnesses lined up that they had looked for and found, and you know, and then this judge had the nerve and was able to simply say, well, he wasn't going to hear any more witnesses, and no more were allowed in closing arguments, you know, and there was nothing they could do about it. So they were so upset by that, and they also had to pay court costs. They weren't fined. They were fined something, not very much. But they had to pay these very large court costs. And that's when, so they got together and they appealed this. And in the appeals court, which where you didn't have Judge Meyer in there, The appeal court found that it was just totally a total travesty of justice. And even 80 years later, the Jewish cabal in charge, you know, who keep all this going, only talk about that first trial. They keep talking, even in newspapers and so on, about how this, even probably on Wikipedia, about how this was found to be a forgery by the court in Bern, Switzerland. But they don't want to tell you about how that decision was overthrown on appeal and declared null and void. And the appeals court ruled that the protocols do not constitute immoral literature in the sense that circulation of the documents calls for punishment. The lower court's conviction was reversed. The two defendants that had been found guilty, only two of the four defendants had to pay a fine or, you know, spend a little time in jail or maybe suspended sentence or something. They were completely exonerated. The money that was assessed to have to be paid by the principal defendant was reassessed to a lesser amount, I think, and then it was put against the state. The state had to pay that amount and reverse their verdict and everything. So it was a total loss for the Jews, this whole thing, and yet we always hear about this Bern trial where the protocols were proved to be a forgery, which is just a big fraud. I think I already went through some of this other. I'm going to go over this thing about the book again. I don't know that I covered all of this in detail, so I'm going to go over this. By 1864, when Joly's book was first published, the Jews of Europe had already achieved a large number of successful and very profitable scams and swindles. They had worldwide operations, you know, they were in control of British, French, and American finances, and they could manipulate government and bribe government officials. At this time, the book that Maurice Joly supposedly wrote in 1864, came out with in 1864, he was a real neophyte, and the conspiratorial stuff that he talks about in the dialogues does not approach the complicated scams outlined in the protocols. He doesn't really show the understanding of money and the effects of state debt. I don't know how true that is, because it's a dialogue between two people, so you can't say which one understood and which one didn't, maybe. But the idea that I'm presenting is that the protocols very well could have been in existence before the year 1884, which is when this woman, Justine Glinka, was doing intelligence work for the Russian government in France. At this time, 1884, you see, and the Dialogue in Hell came out in 1864, and then the protocols came out in 1905 or later. So, these years don't prove they'll say that the protocols, you know, were written in 1905 or things like that, when actually and they totally reject this story that has been put together, and it makes sense to me. I think this is probably the truthful story about it. There's no reason not to believe this. There is no reason to believe the story that the Times of London put out, that this Mr. X approached their correspondent in Constantinople with proof of a forgery. There's no reason to believe that. And when you get to the part where I don't think I ever got to that part, unfortunately. Somehow I canceled it or whatever, but where this French book found its way to Russia and got into the hands of the secret police in Russia, and then they used it to forge this protocols, something like that is what they came up with. And this all took place, you know, in the 1900s. So this is not very believable. I think this other story is believable, which I had never really paid much attention to before, which is this Justine Glinka, a Russian woman, was in France and knew a lot of people. Well, it turns out that the background is that she was actually doing intelligence work for the Russian government in France. Again, you know, that's what's said. I mean, it's possible. I don't know. I haven't, you know, haven't seen any research on this woman in any way that people prove any of these things. It's just one story against another story, basically. So, she heard in some way, either she was approached by this, Joseph, whatever his name was, Schorst, or she approached, she put out the word or something, and she learned that copies were on file in the archives. She had heard about it. I don't know. That's just the way somebody puts it together. In the archives of the Mizraim Masonic Lodge of Paris. Now, it makes sense that the Mizraim Masonic Lodge of Paris would have something like this. This was under the leadership of the Jew Cremieux, who was so involved in political affairs and so very involved in doing work for the Jews outwardly, you know, and making things better for the Jews and giving the Jews more power and so on. And he was also involved in that Damascus affair with Moses Montefiore. Here it is put in a little bit better way than I did. When Jewry, but with the help of Cremieux and Montefiore, successfully but unconvincingly silenced the accusation of ritual murder committed upon the Catholic priest Father Thomas at Damascus in 1840. And then he, you know, all of his associations here of Cremieux and his association with Disraeli and then how that could have been under his auspices, those protocols. And then after his death, this Joseph Schorst decided to make some money for himself and either offered or was approached or something by this Glinka woman and or her friends. And he got a copy of it from that lodge and gave it to her, and it was sent it was translated into Russian and then sent to Russia. And once it came out that it got out, you know, once it became known that that there was such a thing called the protocols and what it was, then they went to Egypt and murdered him, and then they began their work of how to cover it up, what to do with it. Well, this is what I tend to think is believable. People can tear that apart if they want, but I would like to get back to this thing about Sukhothan, but I don't know if I can take the time to find it now in the book. But let me just mention here, I might read this chapter on the Alliance Israelite Universal, which was founded in 1860. Now, you know, this was founded in 1860 by Cremieux and his friends. And then in 1864, Joly came out with his dialogue. And he was a friend and associated with CrimU. So why would not CrimU have played a part in those, in that dialogue between Machiavelli and Montesquieu? Because they were both very anti-Napoleon III. They had both been pro-Napoleon III and had been disappointed by not being given positions in his government. And then they rejected him, or well, with Joly, it wasn't with Napoleon, it was with the predecessor that he didn't get a position. But he never liked Napoleon the Third, Joly. But Crémieux did. He was a supporter, and then he was disappointed because Napoleon didn't give him a position in his government. So then they both had this grudge in common, and they wanted to harm Napoleon III. And so maybe CrimU helped Joly write his dialogue. And then later, and he gave him ideas and so on from what he knew were in these protocols that already existed. And who knows, you know, what name they gave to them. He gave him some ideas from there. Very likely. Maybe he showed him some pages or something. Who knows? And so that came out. And then later when the protocols were discovered, which was never supposed to happen, you have similar passages. Now, this is not far-fetched. This is not unbelievable. Here we have this quote. I'm going to bring this up because it's been brought up. Actually, it's brought up by Hanning Scott. Saying that Robert Faurisson, the well-known Holocaust revisionist, and he is an expert. His expertise as a professor is in document analysis. And he wrote one sentence in his long article on revisionism that he wrote like back around in the 1980s, I think. And in this paragraph was about how revisionists need to steer clear of war propaganda and any kind of wild claims and, you know, the kind of passionate, exaggerated, emotional things that are prevalent and go around. And as revisionists, they have to stick with the facts and be scholarly and not get pulled into anything like that in order to be taken seriously. And one sentence in that paragraph is, he says, Arab propaganda, more than ever, will orchestrate the myths of the Jew draining blood from children or poisoning wells, and will invoke the obvious fake comprised by the protocols of the elders of Zion. Oh, actually, this was written in 2001. Sorry, not back in the 80s. Now, I'm not surprised that he would write that. I do not think by this that it shows that he has looked into or examined the protocols at all, but they are commonly known to be fake accusations against the Jews, just as are draining blood from children and poisoning wells. But the fact is that even though that's the popular conception, the Jews did drain blood from children, and we know that they did. They did. Well, some of us know. Others are in denial about it. And they did poison wells. I'm not saying that, you know, of course it's not true that they just went around poisoning wells all the time, but there are cases in which they poisoned wells, which is a vile kind of a thing to do when you think about it. And so he, you know, throws this stuff together as just what comes to his mind. And I'm going to write to Robert Faurisson, but I don't know if he will even answer such a question, but he might because he's pretty nice. About just what he really knows about the protocols, because I'm quite sure that he just pulled that out because that's the general consensus and he probably goes along with it because he's never really looked into it. So much for that quote from, or so much for saying that Robert Faurisson is a good source for defending, that the protocols are a forgery. Now, the Alliance Israelite Universelle was founded in 1860. Again, as I was going to say, think about these times, these dates and everything. When I think that the Jews, because of, well, the Damascus, that Damascus affair was one thing that kind of gave them an impetus. But they decided that they had to probably, overall, they had some decision that it was time to make more headway for bringing Jews all together as a nation and not letting Jews continue to assimilate into the various nations that they were in, you know. And so because we had had the Enlightenment, there was a lot of, changing of laws to allow Jews more freedom and so on. But there was also in that, what's that called, emancipation of Jews in Europe. There was also along with that the fear that the Jews would assimilate too much and would lose their loyalty and their sense of Jewry separateness. And what we know about the Jews as far as their ancient programs that they do carry forth, unless you want to reject that whole idea, which I don't, that their ancient programs and more modern programs of the serious leading Jews, and you can see, my God, you can see evidence of it, quotes from these people all over the place, in which they reaffirm how the Jews are a nation and all kinds of things about the Jews, even being ruling the world and being God's chosen and so on. Everything, even the very well-known, highly respected Jews have said such things. So now in 1860, they decide to found this Alliance Israelite Universelle. These are important people, and this Crémieux was right in there with them, and he was president of this organization from 3 years after it was first founded, 1863, until 1880. So that is 17 years. He was president of this. And let's see what part. Well, we talked about the Damascus thing. Okay, and how they went. The Crémieux and Moses Montefiore went there and got these Jews off the hook who had been charged with this. And it was very important for them to... it's very important for them to not allow any of these ideas about against Jews, like that Jews blood libels and poisoning wells or, you know, murdering people or having a world plan to take over the world and so on and working together against everyone else. It's very hard, very important for them to always find ways to reject those kind of ideas and not let the Gentiles believe such things. So they had all kinds of help. They had growing influence in the press and so on, as we can see from the London Times in 1921. And they used all this to continue to keep down any kind of movement that would show the people that the Jews really were as bad as they are. That's the way I would see it. And so the chief aim of the Alliance Israelite Universelle was political and was clearly expressed, this is from the book, in the report circulated after its foundation, in which was stated, all important faiths are represented in the world by nations. That is to say, they are incarnated in governments, especially interested in them. Now, they're talking about faiths, okay, religions. And they are officially authorized to represent them, the nations are, and speak for them only. So, you know, they see European nations as basically Christian and Arab nations as basically Muslim and so on and so forth all around the world. You know, they don't have their own nation. They're not a nation. And so, therefore, they are trying to say that their faith is in jeopardy. Their faith, they say, our faith alone is without this important advantage. It is represented neither by a state nor by a society, nor does it occupy a clearly defined territory. Now, here we touch upon the fact that they're very interested in faith. They're very interested in religion. And when they say, that's why I just can't hardly bear when people insist that the Jews love Christianity and they don't hate Christianity because they invented Christianity and they have a purpose for it. Couldn't be further from the truth. Jews hate Christianity. Jews hate other faiths. They want their faith, which is not even really a faith. It's themselves as a ruling body. You could call it a nation. They're not really a nation, but they're a ruling race that's going to rule the world. And they have to protect that. They talk about protecting themselves, but it's really about assuring their supremacy is what it's really about. And so they use their faith, and now they're talking about how their faith is, you know, it doesn't have the advantages that other faiths do. So then it says the Alliance Israelite Universelle, therefore, was destined to be the governmental representative of all Jews from whatever country they lived in under the authority of their secret kahal or community rule. The first political manifestation of the Alliance Israelite Universelle took place at the Berlin Congress in 1878, where it was represented by three of its delegates. This may have been the Three Lands Conference that was brought up last Thursday night in the International Jew, the Conference of the Three Lands, whatever, because here we have three delegates here at this Berlin Congress in 1878, Kahn, Netter, and Veneziana. Veneziana maybe was from Italy. Who knows where the other two were? Somewhere. The link between the Alliance Israelite Universelle and Freemasonry was, for many years, Adolf Grimeau. And Masonic writers have asserted that the 18th degree conferred by the Grand Orient makes the initiate, if not a member, at any rate a supporter of the Alliance. So in the Grand Orient, supposedly here, they have an 18th degree. And when you reach the 18th degree, that means you are supporting this Alliance Israelite Universelle. And it saw its dream of international Jewish government supposedly again shattered when Zionism emerged and came to the fore in 1897. But it is noteworthy that the prophet of Zionism, someone named Ahad Ham, who was really named Asher Ginsburg, was a member of the Alliance Israelite Universelle. So the person who was first promoting Zionism or was the prophet of Zionism, was a member of this alliance, and he was a disciple of Charles Netter, a big Jewish Freemason. The avowed aims of the AIU, namely a supergovernment of the world and a universal religion, both to be Judaic, are being steadily pursued by the Jewish World Agency functioning today. Well, of course, this is somewhat, you could say, propaganda in favor of what the protocols are saying. But so you're on one side or the other, you know, here's the thing. Are we going to believe what the Jews tell us? You know, I mean, is it wise to do that ever? And if the Jews are telling us something, as people like to say, whenever the Jews are open their mouth or whenever they're speaking, they're lying. And it's true that when Jews are talking about Jews and Jewry and what they're all about and what they want and so on, they are always lying. I mean, they can talk about other things and not lie. They can talk about the weather or the traveling somewhere or, you know, any kind of ordinary, normal things, and they can talk without lying. But if they're talking about themselves, they're going to be lying. So are we going to accept what they say, what they have put forth to us about the protocols, without investigating it? That's my point here. And I haven't done, as I warned in the beginning, I wasn't going to do the best job of putting this together in a real tight way. I haven't had time to do it, but I did want to talk about it. Because as I get what I do know out there, when I talk about things, it kind of settles it in me in a way. And then I can move on and continue and go further with it. But until I do that, I'm kind of stuck and overloaded with information that I have to start processing in some way. And it's easier to talk about it than to try to start writing all this down. I have too much to write as it is. So that's how I'm apologizing for my not very good job today, but I do think that the point I'm making now is very valid and that it needs to be investigated. And I believe that the people on our side who are saying, oh, are going along with the forgery claim and say, oh, this, we don't want to look at this, this is, makes us look stupid, have not investigated it. I know they have not investigated it. Or they wouldn't be saying what they're saying. So I'm learning more and more that a lot of people who are good, they have a lot to say. They still say a lot of things that they don't know anything about. And most of us do. You know, who to find a real expert on this in this area is quite difficult. And even those who have looked into it deeply. Or looked into it, let's say, you know, in detail, are not sure about anything, but they fall mostly on the side of that the protocols are not a forgery, however they came about. And I think we've got some good clues about how they came about and where they may have got started. And well, I think they got started way back, and I think they've been kind of perfecting them over time, and that's what the version was that finally got out. That is the current version of what they have been working on for some time. That's why I don't think it wasn't that it was just written. Well, I have run out of time, and I hope I have made a little bit of sense here at the end. So I thank you all for listening, and I don't know exactly how I'll carry on with this, but I hope you all do some investigation of your own and look at the links that I put on the program page. Thanks a lot, and come back next week. This is Carolyn on Saturday Afternoon.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.